Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I want to welcome you to our Independent Policy Forum this evening. As most of you know, we conduct these programs roughly monthly and feature outstanding scholars and other experts who have written important new books on important issues. And tonight is certainly no exception. This is the book that we're featuring today, Law's Order, by our speaker, David Friedman. I hope that everyone has gotten several copies. I mean, great presents, graduation, whatever. The actual title of tonight's talk is Will Encryption Protect Privacy and Make Government Obsolete? Some of us might wonder if it had ever been otherwise. David is actually trained as a physicist and an economist. Teaches at the law school at Santa Clara University because of his extensive knowledge in law and economics and other related fields. As many of you know, the Institute regularly sponsors programs like this. We're a public policy research institute. We produce many books. This is our quarterly journal, which I hope everyone here also is subscribing to for everyone in the family. This particular issue has a number of articles that pertain to privacy-related issues, especially pertaining to the nanny state, national security, and other matters. I wanted to recognize Robert Mondavi Wineries, who very kindly donate the wine that we have enjoyed, and also the customer company, which co-sponsors our programs. For those of you who are new to the Institute, in the registration packet, you'll find background information about our program, including how you can become a member and receive discounts and the journal and many other benefits. We also invite you to visit our website. We have a superb archive of previous events available in transcript and audio and so forth, as well as information about many of our publications. Our next event will be on May 16th. The program will focus on the ideas and significance of the Nobel laureate economist and political theorist F.A. Hayek. The program is entitled Friedrich Hayek and the Future of Freedom. The speakers will be Alan Ebenstein, who has a new book called Friedrich Hayek, A Biography, and Charles Baird, professor of economics at Cal State Hayward. On July 5th, we'll be hosting a program called Why Are the Public Schools Failing and What Can Be Done? The speakers then will be two economists, one whose name is John Merrifield, from the University of Texas at San Antonio, who's author of a new book called The School Choice Wars, and Richard Vedder, who is a senior fellow here and also professor of economics at Ohio University, who's author of a new monograph for us called Can Teachers Own Their Own Schools? Later, on August 14th, we'll be hosting Larry Elder, who many of you know is a popular radio and TV talk show host and personality, and his book entitled 10 Things You Can't Say in America. We'll also be hosting Thomas Zaz this fall on his new book called Pharmocracy, which is excerpted, I should mention, in this new issue of Independent Review. Last Friday, some of you may have noticed that the Washington Post reported on the efforts of the government in China to continue its efforts to censor information technology. The questions that our speaker will be looking at is, can such repression work? And what are the pros and cons to such efforts? On the one hand, China was apparently ineffective in blocking the access that people tried to have to foreign news accounts related to the recent spy plane incident. Furthermore, the U.S. plane, I'm not sure if you had noticed some of the reports that mentioned the plane was equipped with the latest NSA technology that enables the government to intercept all email, faxes, and other electronic media. So it wasn't simply a question of surveillance of certain specific things, but it could survey virtually all transactions. Just imagine the uproar here in the U.S. if the Chinese or the Cubans were flying continual surveillance flights along the west or the east coast of the U.S., monitoring all communications media. On the other hand, when the truth about a deadly school explosion spread earlier across Chinese chat rooms, it turned out that government officials were essentially powerless to stop it. And they actually issued what was essentially a remarkable public apology. So that's part of what our speaker will be discussing, this tension between these two dynamics. The U.S. itself, of course, the home of the FBI's carnivore surveillance system, as well as the NSA's Echelon system, which is actually an international system. In Congress, we currently have a bill that's proposed that includes a provision to make it mandatory to have a special chip embedded in all new cell phones by the year, I believe it's 2005. Would enable the government to track the location of all cell phone use and their users. Clearly, the subject of privacy is no longer the exclusive domain of speculative thinkers or futurists. It is a fact of public debate. The question, one of the questions to ask is, will privacy-enhancing technology improve faster than privacy-threatening technology? Should the government make standards of privacy? Should it enforce contracts in cyberspace, or would private law do a better job? Tonight, our speaker will discuss many of these issues. David Friedman, as I mentioned, is a professor of law at Santa Clara University. He received his PhD in physics from the University of Chicago. I went to the University of Chicago, but not in physics. He has taught at Cornell, University of Chicago, Tulane, UCLA, Virginia Polytechnic Institute, University of California at Irvine, University of Pennsylvania, and Columbia University. In addition to his new book, Law's Order, he's also the author of The Machinery of Freedom. And if you haven't read The Machinery of Freedom, you've really missed a very important and, I think, stimulating book. Also, the book Price Theory and the book Hidden Order, which is also one I'd highly recommend. He's contributed to the new Palgrave. He is the author of many articles and reviews in many economics journals, such as the American Economic Review, the Journal of Law and Economics, the Journal of Political Economy, Economics and Philosophy, and so forth. David is also well known for pioneering some of the most creative and insightful critical analysis of government institutions and setting forth a non-state approach to social cooperation and human endeavor. I'm very pleased to introduce David Friedman.
Actually, David Thoreau doesn't know what I'm going to say because he hasn't heard the talk either. I have written important books on importance. You really need this thing for something?
Yeah.
I see, all right. I've written, I regard the microphone as a device for distorting the human voice. I was going to say, I have written important books on important subjects, but I have not written any books on the subject I'm talking about tonight. I do have some things on my website on that topic, in particular an old article called Strong Privacy, Perils and Promises of Encryption, which is really the written version of what I'm saying as of 5 or 6 years ago when I wrote the article. I am afraid government is not obsolete yet. Government is very good at what it does, enormously better than any competing institution. And if you don't believe me, compare the total revenue collected by the U.S. government each year with the total of all private theft and robbery in the U.S. It's orders of magnitude larger. It is a very successful institution. But what I wanted to talk about was not the government, although we'll come back to that. I wanted to start out talking about the question of how you can maintain your privacy, because there are really two ways of protecting your privacy, and one of them doesn't work. The one that doesn't work, which is, of course, the method central to all privacy law, is to let information about you out and then control how other people use it. And if you believe it does work, I suggest a very simple experiment. The Fair Credit Reporting Act, federal law, forbids credit agencies to release credit reports on people except to those who have a legitimate need for the credit report. So the experiment is to start with the name of a random person, $10,000, and the yellow pages for private detectives for your city, and see whether you can end with a credit report on that random person. And I predict the, if you are reasonably ingenious, the answer will be yes, and you'll have money left. The other way of protecting your privacy, the way that works, is to keep control over the information from the beginning. That is, not to let the information out. And it turns out that the technologies that have developed over the last few decades make possible very, very powerful tools for that kind of privacy. And the central technology, which some of you know lots about, but some of you know very little about, and I therefore have to talk about, is public key encryption. All right, you want to send a message to somebody, and you want to make sure that if it's intercepted, strangers can't read it. And the old, not very old, the 50-year-old solution to this problem was that you had a way of encrypting the message, a way of scrambling the message, which depended on a key, a set of instructions for scrambling. And you used the key to scramble the message. You sent it to somebody, and he used the key to unscramble. Now, if you think about it, there is a fundamental problem with this technology. And the problem is that the reason you need encryption is that you don't have a secure communication channel. The reason you need encryption is that when you send messages to people, they might get intercepted. But then when you send the key to him, that might get intercepted too. And if the key has been intercepted, especially if you don't know it's been intercepted, then somebody else can read your mail. All right? So the traditional single key system has very serious limitations. It's workable for governments that can afford to send military attachés with briefcases handcuffed to their wrists hither and yon about the world, but it isn't very practical for the rest of us. And the solution is a mathematical discovery made a few decades ago called public key encryption. And the way public key encryption works is that you generate two keys. Each of these is simply a long number. And these keys have a rather complicated mathematical relationship to each other, which has the result that if you use one key to encrypt a message, that key cannot decrypt it. It depends on the fact that there are some mathematical operations that are much harder to do in one direction than the other. But the other key of the pair will decrypt it. So you roll up a key pair, and you declare one of the two members of the pair to be your public key. And you give it to everybody in sight. And now anybody who wants to send a message to you encrypts the message using your public key, sends it to you, and you decrypt it with your private key. And since your private key has never left your possession, you don't need any secure communication channel. All right? And if the people who are spying on you manage to steal a copy of your public key, that's fine. They can send you secret messages too. So it's a very simple and elegant idea, and I'm not going to try to describe the mathematics of it, but you, if you're really curious, if you go up on the web, there's a firm called RSA, which is, in a sense, the major firm in this business, and last time I looked, they had extensive web page explanations of how public key encryption works, at least how their algorithms for public key encryption work. It turns out that this single technology provides a whole lot of separate pieces that you can put together to what I think of, to get what I think of as a world of strong privacy, a world in which people can interact with each other with quite a high degree of confidence that no third party can know what they're saying, know who they're talking to, trace their financial transactions, or in any way get information about what they're doing. The first technology is encryption itself, and the only tricky part is how you distribute your public key, how you make sure people really know it's your public key. And we can talk about that if people want, but for the moment, just assume we have some way of doing that. Once you've done that, the next problem is when you are dealing with people who haven't seen you at a distance, how do you prove you're you? How do you prove that when you are proposing a revolt against the U.S. government, you're not really an FBI agent in disguise? Think of other cases where FBI agents like to disguise themselves as 12-year-old girls, for example, other law enforcement purposes. But how can you have a system where people can prove they're them? And this is really two questions. One of them is, how do I prove I'm David Friedman, who teaches at Santa Clara? Because for some purposes, I might want to send a communication in which I identified myself. And the other question is, how do I prove I'm the same unknown person who communicated with you last week? So the first question is how I link my cyberspace identity to my real space identity. But the second and more interesting question is how I prove my cyberspace identity. Because I'm going to be arguing that there are a lot of purposes for which you don't want to link those two identities, for which you want to keep the cyberspace identity anonymous in real space, but not in cyberspace. And the solution to this is something called a digital signature. And what I'll describe is a slightly simpler method than is really used, but it would work and it will do. And the method is quite simple. I wish to send you a message and prove it's from me. So I encrypt the message with my private key. I then add a note to it saying this is from David Friedman and send it to you. You get the message. You decrypt it with my public key. Remember, what's encrypted with either key can be decrypted with the other. Since it turns out to be a message and not gibberish, you know it must have been encrypted with the private key that matches my public key. I'm the only person in the world who has the private key that matches my public key. Hence, I must have sent the message. That's the guts of how digital signatures work. And not only does that mean that I can prove that I'm me, it also means that if necessary, you can later prove to a third party that I sent that message even if I deny it. Because you now have in your possession the message encrypted with my private key. And the only way you can have gotten that is from me. So it provides not just identity, but non-deniable identity, as it were. It provides what a signature on a contract is supposed to provide, but much more reliable. Not perfectly. I could be careless and somebody stole my private key. That's my fault. But the only thing I've got to do, essentially, in this system is make sure that my private key is secret. And since I never have to show it to anybody, that should not be impossibly difficult. So we now have the ability to communicate securely and the ability to prove either my cyberspace identity or my real space identity, as I prefer. I should say the way I prove my real space identity is I go to some respected organization, say American Express or the Catholic Church or whoever you and I both trust. Which organization itself has its public key well known? All right, I really go to VeriSign, which is a private firm in this business, but no reason you would have heard of it. And that organization, I go to them and I show them my passport and I show them my face and I show them my driver's license and I show them my public key. And then they write what's called a digital certificate, which essentially is a statement intended to be read by a computer, which says, David D. Friedman, who teaches at Santa Clara and lives in the following place, has public key such and such. They digitally sign it with their private key. Now I can send anybody in the world who knows their public key that certificate. They check that American Express really checked that I'm me, and now they know my public key, and now they can trust my digital signature. So that's how I demonstrate my real space identity. For my cyberspace identity, all I do is the first time I communicate with you, I give you my public key, and thereafter anybody who can send you digital signatures which check with that public key is me. That's the basic logic of it. Now we can communicate with identity and with privacy, but we still have to worry about people seeing who you're talking to, because that's one common way of breaking privacy. And the solution to that, there are a couple of solutions, but the easiest one is something called an anonymous remailer. And the idea is very simple. When I want to send the message to you, instead of sending it directly to you, I send it to David here, who's an anonymous remailer, along with your email. And he forwards it to you. Now, of course, that doesn't work, because now if somebody intercepts it, they can read the email address and know. Or alternatively, they can just watch the message come into him, go out from him, see where it came from and who it went to. I'm assuming a spy who's watching the whole system. The beauty of these technologies is that even with that spy, you're still safe. And so what I do, what I left out when I was describing it, is first I take the message. I encrypt it with your public key, because I don't want him to read my mail. Then I add to that your email address unencrypted, and I encrypt all of that with his public key, the remailer's public key. Now The message goes into him. He strips off the top layer of encryption, which is with his public key. He can now read the email address that he forwards it to you. Observe that somebody who intercepts the message when it's coming from me can't read the email address because it's encrypted with his public key. And somebody who's watching him can't tell which incoming message matches which outgoing message. Because, of course, since he's in the business, he's running 6,000 a minute. And the messages look different when one layer of encryption is stripped off. All right. Now you say there's still one remaining problem, and that is that David may be working for the FBI. That's all right. It wasn't your email address that it was being forwarded to. It was the email address of another anonymous remailer. And there was another layer of encryption and another email address. And, of course, that I don't trust him either because, you know, the FBI has been very energetic nowadays. So that was going to another one. So my email message bounces through 10 anonymous remailers before it reaches the intended recipient. And if you think of the logic of the system, unless all 10 are working for the same bad guys, I'm safe. Because any one broken link means you can't trace the line. So it really is a fairly powerful way of doing it. The remaining problem is how I can make payments, because in order to do many things, you have to be able to pay people money. How I can make payments without being traceable. And credit cards and checks aren't a very good solution, for obvious reasons. But it turns out that using encryption technology, you can create what is referred to as anonymous digital cash or anonymous e-cash. And I'm not going to go into details. If people are curious, I can describe a way you could do it much simpler than the way people actually propose to do it. But the basic effect, and again, I assume we're going to have a question period, and therefore I can skip over things, and if people find them puzzling, they can call me on them. But the basic effect is that I send you a piece of information, and the result of your having that piece of information is that you now have control over an asset that I used to control. And you can send the information on to somebody else, and he can send it on to somebody else, and the 100th person walks into the bank and takes the dollar bill that information represents, and it's done in such a way that each transaction, I lose control as you get control, that you, in effect, the information changes each time it's transmitted, so my old information is now obsolete. And the result is you get the same anonymity that cash gives you, that it is true if our money were still redeemable for silver, at some point the dollar bill comes in and gets redeemed, but it doesn't have a history on it. It doesn't say where it's been, and therefore it can't be used to trace transactions. And you can do exactly the same thing with anonymous e-cash. So what is the result of this set of technologies? It's a very interesting world. To begin with, it is a world where you can simultaneously have anonymity and reputation. All right, that sounds paradoxical, but I can have a cyberspace persona defined by a public key, and you can roll up public keys anytime you like, public-private key pairs. So I have a cyberspace persona defined by a public key, and I can choose never to link that cyberspace persona to a real space persona so that I can develop a reputation. Suppose, for example, that I wanted to practice law without a license. I'm not, in fact, a member of the bar. So if I want to give legal advice and I'm worried about getting into trouble, I set up online and I offer free legal advice for a while. And when people have concluded that my legal advice is good, I start charging for it. And I get a reputation as a good source of legal advice, and at some point the American Bar Association hears about this and they say, we want to arrest this person. And so they send me a message, because there's some way of sending me messages through remailers, and the message says, please come here so we can arrest you. And I throw it in the wastebasket, and that's the end of it, because they don't even know what continent I'm on, or whether I'm a man or a woman, or, you know, a very bright 12-year-old, or a 90-year-old who hasn't gotten senile yet. So that's a very interesting feature of this system. And it has both attractive and unattractive results. One obvious attractive result is that freedom of speech no longer depends on the legal doctrines of the Supreme Court. It only depends on the laws of mathematics. Now, I don't want to badmouth the Supreme Court. Freedom of speech is one of the few issues they've been pretty good on historically. But, you know, that was last decade. There's no predicting what they'll do next decade. And I prefer a system where violating freedom of speech is not merely illegal, but impossible, where they're unable to do it, not merely not allowed to do it. That's the good bit. On the other hand, another good bit, well, people in this room will think it's a good bit, other people won't, is that you can't tax or regulate something you can't see. All right? If I earn money in cyberspace and spend it in real space, they can tax it when I spend it. If I earn money in real space and spend it in cyberspace, they can tax it when I earn it. But if I earn money in cyberspace and spend it in cyberspace, in particular if I'm spending it for information goods, for computer programs or videos or consulting databases or services, for anything which can be transmitted over the computer rather than having to be delivered by a UPS van, now both the earning and the spending of the money are invisible, and it now vanishes from the IRS. Ditto for regulation, as in my example of practicing law without a license. Right? Presumably most of you will think this is a good thing. Some people won't. They have reasonable arguments for their position, although I think they're mistaken. They think there are good things the government does and it needs money to do them with. But let me go on to a consequence that even some of us may be unhappy with. And that is that it becomes possible to have criminal firms with brand name reputation. And I like to think of it in terms of my business plan for Murder Incorporated. Because I say to myself, suppose I wanted to kill somebody, me right now. What, other than moral reservations, which might depend on who I was thinking of killing, what keeps me from doing it? And the answer is not the price. All right? As far as I can gather from published reports, the cost of a hitman is less than the cost of a new car. And we bought a new car quite recently. We could afford that. All right? What keeps me from doing it is that I don't have any safe way of locating a reliable seller of that service. If I were a professional criminal, I would. I would have the right contacts. But ordinary citizens don't. This problem we can solve. All right? So think about my world of strong privacy. And the business plan goes as follows. Step one is a series of mysterious billboards placed at very high density places, you know, on big highways. And all the billboard has is a series of numbers, digits, and the statement, write down this number. That's it. The next thing that happens a week or two later is that the New York Times and the Christian Science Monitor and a few other major newspapers receive a long classified ad, or at least a long ad, which appears to be gibberish. And maybe there's a sign above it saying, save this ad. The next thing is a very high-profile assassination. I don't think politicians are important enough. I think a bomb at the Academy Awards is probably the optimal marketing strategy. But you might manage it, at the World Series instead, on the field, of course. So in any case, we in some way kill a bunch of people who get a lot of attention. And as soon as that happens, emails go, of course, through anonymous remailers to all of the newspapers that we published this ad in, pointing out that if they take the number which was on that billboard and use it to decrypt the ad, they will find something interesting. And what they will find is a description of our assassination published 2 days before the assassination occurred. So we have just demonstrated two things. One, we have an organization that is willing and able to kill people. And two, what its public key is. All right? The rest is details. We now, since all the world has our public key, all the world can send us messages with confidence that nobody else but us can read it. All the world can check that messages from us are really from us. We are going to have to set up some protocols for getting messages to us through remailers, but that shouldn't be too hard. And now people can buy our services. We are Murder Incorporated. That was also in the encrypted ad, of course. And we are looking for business. Right? So that's the unattractive. That's the downside of strong privacy. And you can think of other less exotic cases. For example, Trade Secrets Incorporated. We buy and sell. Or a pirate archive, which sells other people's intellectual property at a penny on the dollar in anonymous digital cash. So there are a bunch of opportunities for criminals, which exist ultimately because this technology prevents the enforcement of law, of certain kinds of laws. And although some laws shouldn't be enforced, some should, such as the law against murder, and both are becoming hard. My prejudice is that weakening government is on net a good thing, but that doesn't mean that it has no bad consequences. Let me, however, raise a very general point about technological progress with some specific applications. And that is that technological change makes some things harder to do and some things easier to do. And when something you want to do gets very hard, what you ought to start thinking about is there some other way of achieving this objective that's just gotten easier? And in this case, at least a partial solution to Murder Incorporated is that if I am going to do things which will make people want to murder me, I do them online with my cyberspace identity, because there's no way that Murder Incorporated can get a bullet through a T1 line. All right? So at the same technology, on the one hand, makes murder easier by solving one of the problems in arranging for murder. Of course, they still have to kill people. You can still protect yourself in real space. It takes a bullet in real space. But at the same time, it makes one of the defenses against murder, namely anonymity, easier. And of course, that suggests some of the reasons why people may choose to do business anonymously. That the reasons for you and me aren't all that strong. I mean, tax evasion is very nice, but it's not worth enormous amounts of trouble. And in fact, I don't encrypt at the moment. I don't have many secrets. But there are quite a lot of people who live in countries where, difficult though it may be to imagine, property rights are considerably less secure than they are here. And where letting either your government or your neighbors know that you're rich is very risky unless you've made an adequate investment in political influence. And in those countries, the idea of being able to sell valuable services, say computer programming or other things, in a way such that no third party knows that you're the person getting that income is going to be very attractive. All right. Some reasons to do it here, more reasons to do it elsewhere. Let me go on to discuss the question of using the technology to solve the problems the technology raises, but in a different and somewhat more detailed context. And that's the question of enforcing contracts. Because in general, contracts in cyberspace raise a problem. They raise two problems. Even without anonymity, they raise a problem because national boundaries are transparent in cyberspace. And therefore, you would like to be able to do business with people without worrying about what state or country they're in. However, although it's possible to enforce contracts in the court across jurisdictional and national boundaries, it's relatively complicated, slow, expensive, and therefore much more difficult than for contracts with your neighbors. Hence, using the courts to enforce contracts is going to be somewhat more difficult in cyberspace than in real space. If the world I sketched comes into existence, it's going to be a whole lot more difficult, because there's no way the court can enforce a contract against somebody if they don't know who he is. All right? On the other hand, if you actually think about contract enforcement in the real world, it should occur to you that there are two mechanisms by which we do it, and using law courts is the less important. That most individuals and most firms keep their promises most of the time, not because they're afraid of being sued, but because they don't want a bad reputation. Some of you may remember the wonderful line in The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Heinlein, where Manny is saying, why on earth? They have laws for everything. They even have laws for private contracts. Why would you do business with a guy if you needed a lawyer? Doesn't he have a reputation? Anyway, it's a good passage. Good book. Great book. But what I want to argue is that at the same time that moving to online commerce makes legal enforcement more difficult, it makes reputational enforcement easier. And there are a couple of reasons. To begin with, if you think about reputational enforcement, the crucial variable is the cost to interested third parties of finding out who cheated who. Suppose that you and I have a deal and you cheated me. And I say, I'm going to tell everybody that you cheated me. And you say, well, I'll deny it. And let us suppose, as is often the case, that for the third parties who might care whether you're honest, figuring out whether you cheated me is costly. Because you're going to do your best to argue that you were the wrong party and I cheated you. That not only reduces the effect of the reputational sanction, it also gives me a reason not to complain in the first place. Because if you didn't cheat me, I cheated you. And thus, when I complain, both of our reputations go down if other people can't check which of us is in the wrong. So it's crucial, in order for a reputational system to work well, that interested third parties be able at low cost to know who's acting badly. And the internet helps in two ways. First, it makes finding information and transmitting information very quick and easy, so that in a casual sense, you can do a search using Google of the web and of Usenet, and in a minute see if anybody has mentioned the firm you're thinking of doing business with and what they say about it. Somewhat more organized fashion, as many of you know, eBay has deliberately gone out of its way to set up reputational mechanisms. That is to set things up so that when you buy something on eBay, after the goods are delivered, you have an opportunity to report on the transaction, and those reports are available to anybody else who wants to buy from that seller. So those sorts of reputational mechanisms work. Let me describe a more formal reputational mechanism that one could use if larger amounts were at stake. It goes as follows. You and I sign a contract. In the contract, we specify a private arbitrator. The contract includes the private arbitrator's public key, which you'll remember is the information you need to check his digital signature. The contract is digitally signed by both you and me. Now, you think I violated the contract. You demand arbitration. The arbitrator rules that I owe you $10,000 in damages. I refuse to pay. The arbitrator writes a brief statement that I agreed to, that he would be the arbitrator of disputes, that he gave a verdict, and that I refused to pay the damages. Digitally signs it and gives it to you. You now have a package. That package consists of the original contract, which I digitally signed, so provably I agreed to it, and the arbitrator's verdict, which he digitally signed, so provably the arbitrator I agreed to said that I cheated. You may now email that package to anybody else in the industry. You can put it up on a website with my name all over it, so anybody who does a web search for me will find it. In various low-cost ways, you can make it readily available to the world. And the beauty of it is that when somebody gets the package, it takes his computer 4 seconds or something less than 4 seconds to find out that I cheated you, because all it has to do is verify the digital signatures. Obviously, if this is a routine procedure, we'll have standard ways of formatting the information so that no human being has to intervene and the computer can just check it and then say, hey boss, this guy cheats. So that means that it's a technology that makes it possible to drastically reduce the cost of to interested third parties of knowing who cheated. And it's really two technologies. One is the very old one, and that's arbitration. And the point of the arbitration is that it provides a cheap way for third parties to figure out who was in the wrong, because the arbitrator has done all the work, and all they have to know is I agreed to that arbitrator, and that arbitrator says I'm in the wrong. And that exists at present. It's existed for a long time. Articles on private arbitration in various industries, mostly written by Lisa Bernstein, who's been very enterprising in this field, starting with her classic article about the New York diamond industry, which is possibly the world's most trust-intensive industry, in which almost nobody uses the courts, because the courts don't let you keep secrets, and people have secrets, and for several other reasons. So, in any case, now, there is a problem, of course, which is suppose I want to make a contract with someone who has no reputation. He's not a repeat player in this market, say. Well, the solution to that is you piggyback on somebody else who does have a reputation, and you do it by bonding. So that I want to make a contract, and the maximum damages I'm going to be liable for are $10,000. So we agree on an arbitrator who is also a bonding agent. Each of us deposits $10,000 in digital cash with him. Of course, our contract with him specifies the arbitrator that he and we agree to use if we disagree with his verdict. Make sure he can't steal the money, which he probably won't do for reputational reasons anyway. And now, if he finds that I defaulted on the contract, he can award some of my money to you as damages. So the crucial thing now is that the bonding agent arbitrator has a reputation, and that makes him honest. And once he's honest, we just trust him and thus get our enforcement secondhand. You can think of other mechanisms as well, but I think this is enough to make the point that you can have a system for enforcing contracts entirely private, entirely reputational. Now, of course, one implication is that if you're a new boy on the block, other than bonding, you aren't going to be able to make large contracts. But that's often true in the real world as well, that you develop a reputation for a while by making small contracts, and as the reputation becomes larger, people are willing to make larger dealings. This could be the story of the 21st century, but it could also be the story of about the 12th century. Because as many of you may know, our present system of mercantile law ultimately has its roots in the Lex Mercantoria, which was a legal system that was evolved by the fair courts of medieval Europe entirely as private law. That is, this was a context where you had lots of small governmental units with varying legal rules. You had courts at which merchants met from all over Europe. So they evolved their own system of legal rules, which was enforced primarily by reputational sanctions, and later got taken over, at least in England, by the common law, sort of adopted into it, and I suppose ultimately ends up as the UCC, largely. So this is not entirely new. One of the attractive features of this system is that it is a system for generating efficient law, because when you are deciding what arbitrator to write into your contract, you want the arbitrator who has the legal rules that on average maximize the sum gains for the contracting parties. So you want the arbitrator who gets the right result at low cost, doesn't take bribes, follows legal rules that don't result in you doing expensive things to avoid damages and so forth. So this is actually a market mechanism for generating efficient law on the private market. And I found that attractive because I, in fact, described that mechanism in 1971 when I wrote my first book, in which I was describing an imaginary anarcho-capitalist society. I was trying to sketch out how a society could work with private property rights but without government. And one of the points I made after showing how the legal institutions had worked, this was not a reputational enforcement, these were ones where, if necessary, they could shoot people. But after showing how the legal institutions worked, I proceeded to show why they would have market reasons to generate efficient law. And I argued at the time that one of the great advantages of my version of libertarianism over the minarchist version was that the minarchist version has no reason to expect its institutions to actually generate the right law. It just assumes they do. Whereas in mine, I have economic reasons to expect it to generate economically efficient law, and pretty persuasive reasons to believe that freedom is usually economically efficient, and that therefore there will be a close, though not perfect, correlation between economically efficient law and libertarian law. So here it looks as though I don't have to wait 200 years for anarcho-capitalism to show up and transform the world. It's going to be happening more or less around us in cyberspace, not in real space, but in cyberspace in the form of the kind of private law I've described, which I think is already developing. Now, I could talk about other things along these lines as well, but I'm going pretty long. So let me instead give you some sort of summary comments, and then we can discuss things. and lots of more things to talk about, but time is short and ours is long, as our speakers. Let me say a little bit about in what I at least am guessing, and it's only a guess because prediction is, I think, a hazardous business, and I'm not in the prophecy business, but my guess of what's going to happen is that we're going to be moving towards a world where you have two sets of institutions, one in cyberspace and one in real space. And the institutions in cyberspace are going to be voluntary institutions, because the fundamental nature of cyberspace interaction is that all you're doing is sending messages. Right? Again, you can't get a bullet through a T1 line. So that means that although it's true you can defraud people, and ultimately things like computer break-ins, if you think them through, are versions of fraud, you can't use force. And, you know, we're unhappy with both force and fraud, but force is a lot more dangerous. Fraud you can protect yourself against if you're careful. Force you can't. So it's going to be a world of voluntary association, private law, all these nice things. It'll give us problems where you are working on the interface between cyberspace and real space, where you use the privacy of cyberspace to contract for a real space assassination. That's where the problems are going to exist. But as long as you're only in cyberspace, you can't really assassinate people. Not doable. On the other hand, the real space will still belong to the state, unfortunately. However, the state will be weakened in two interesting ways. The first is that the more of your life is in cyberspace, the more mobile you are, because it means that if you're working in a virtual firm, if your friends are largely people you know in virtual reality who might be anywhere, now if you don't like the government that's taxing you, you know, you move 1,000 miles across the border and you put a dot forward file in your email file so your email all follows you, and you have to get a new house, but nothing else changes very much. So the more mobile people are, the more governments have to compete for taxpayers, and thus the less they can steal. Very general rule, one which I sketched out in my first economics article a very, very long time ago, where I was analyzing the size and shape of nations and arguing that large, linguistically homogeneous nations were a result of rising incomes, because it meant that human income was a major tax source, and if you want to tax human beings, you've got to make sure there's nowhere outside of your control they want to live. So I claim that explained the linguistic nationalism of the 19th century. Economic Theory of the Size and Shape of Nations, Journal of Political Economy, 1976, I think. Anyway, so that's one effect. The second effect is that governments are going to be weaker because they cannot control information flows. And this is what I've come to refer, especially when talking to my conservative friends, as the virtual Second Amendment. That if you think about the Second Amendment, right to keep and bear arms, I think it's pretty clear what's going on. And it's clear if you read, say, Adam Smith, who's, as I assume you all know, that the important event of the year 1776 was not any of this nonsense going on in the colonies. That was the year that The Wealth of Nations was published. Anyway, Smith discusses the question of militias. He doesn't come up with the same conclusion. But it's clear that the sort of the intellectual background of the late 18th century that is facing this problem. Professional soldiers are better than amateurs. They win battles. But professional armies are a potential threat to a free state, because when the government gets tyrannical, the army does what it's told. Remember that Cromwell is a military dictator of England in the mid-17th century. So this is stuff people are still remembering. It's only 100 years ago, a little more than 100 years ago. And the American solution, which I think was a very ingenious solution, is that you have a big militia. The militia is officered by the states, not by the federal government. It's the federal government that owns the professional army. The federal government makes the drill rules so that if the militia is functioning as an adjunct to the federal army, they can all work together, but it doesn't have any control over the militia. And this saves you in two directions. First, it means you don't need a very big professional army, because although your militia isn't very good, there's lots of it. So you can get along with a smaller professional army. And second, it means that if the federal government engages in tyranny and uses the professional army, the militia outguns it 100-1. And even if they're not as good, that's good enough. That was the theory. I don't think that works anymore. All right? I think that's probably a good explanation of why we had the Second Amendment. But much as it pains me to say it, I think that's obsolete. I think it's obsolete because the difference between the weapons a hunter uses and the weapons a soldier uses is a whole lot better now, bigger now than it was in the 18th century. And that while having an armed populace no doubt makes tyranny a little less likely, it's not really a very effective protection. On the other hand, my guess is that any serious conflicts between the U.S. government and citizens are going to be mainly information wars, not mainly bullet wars. And for information wars, I want to argue, widespread use of public key encryption is the virtual equivalent of the right to keep and bear arms. Because it means not that government isn't allowed to do bad things, but that government doesn't have the power to do bad things. See, that's the elegance of the Second Amendment. It's not saying, the Second Amendment doesn't say government may not establish a tyranny. The Second Amendment says we will set up a situation in which if they try to establish a tyranny, they will lose. Right? And that, it seems to me, is also the attractive feature of widespread use of strong encryption, that it means that if they try to censor people, they will lose in the long term. So that's my view, at least, of the future we face. Now, the final question is, why won't they stop it? Because I've got to tell you, I'm not the first person to think of these things. All right? And while most of the other people who think of these things are also nutty libertarian types, the basic history of these ideas is that I stole them from a bunch of people called cypherpunks, of whom the leading light is Tim May, who stole some of them from me. That is to say, Tim read Machinery of Freedom. He then took what he knew about online stuff, which I knew nothing about when I wrote the book, and evolved my ideas and other ideas into his ideas about the sort of crypto-anarchy I've been describing, and then I stole the ideas back from him, which is only fair. But there is another set of people who've been thinking about these things for a long time, and they're very smart people, and they all work for the National Security Agency. All right, they're the other encryption people. So the bad guys know about it, too. All right? Why, therefore, has encryption have the attempts to regulate encryption, of which the most famous was the Clipper Chip initiative, which some of you know about, and there have been others, why have they so far been flops? And why do I think, though I could be wrong, but I think they're going to keep being flops, at least in the U.S.? And the ultimate reason is because governments have very short time horizons. All right. Think about the question of to what degree you are willing to accept a cost now for a benefit in the future. The critical question is whether you have secure property rights. All right? You're thinking about planting black walnut trees, and they take, let us say, 40 years to mature. In a world of secure property rights, you plant the black walnut trees. In 20 years, you sell that forest to somebody else who's willing to wait another 20 years. 20 more years, he harvests the trees. And it's worth making such long-term investments. In a world of insecure property rights, by the time 20 years have passed, the odds are very high that somebody has stolen your walnut trees or the land they're standing on, someone either a government or a private party. And therefore, you only make investments with short-term payoffs. In our political system, political actors have insecure property rights. All right? President Clinton could rent the White House. He couldn't sell it. That's an important fact. He didn't own it. What does that mean? It means that Clinton was not willing to accept short-term political costs in order to make sure that the president 20 years later could collect taxes. All right? But if you think about the nature of encryption regulation, because encryption and digital signatures are key technologies for making online commerce work, because in online commerce you're moving lots of valuable information and money around, and you can't do it if you can't protect it, it follows that serious limitations on encryption are going to make it much harder to develop online commerce, and they're going to do it right now. That's going to be a big political hit now. Why will they do it? In order that we can't cheat on our taxes 10 or 20 years from now, but Mr. Bush doesn't care about 20 years from now either. So that's why the prediction that I made back at the beginning of the Clipper Chip stuff, which so far is hell, is that the political actors won't be willing to take the short-term hits that they need in order to block this, assuming they can block it. And once it's well established, it's very hard to do anything about it. So that's my guess. I may be wrong. I'm doubtless an optimist by nature, but I think that's what's been happening and is going to continue to happen. Who is it who tries to block it? And the answer is, it's the long-lived bureaucracies, because the NSA has much more secure property rights in its turf than Clinton does in his. So does the FBI. So it's been the NSA and the FBI pushing it, and it's been the Clintons not getting pushed, because they'd be the ones who'd have to take the heat, and they don't want to take the heat. And so far, at least, that's worked. It may or may not continue, but that's my guess. So therefore, my guess of the future we face, and I may be wrong, but my guess is that it's going to be a future where people who choose privacy can, in fact, have it. Take a few years to get all of the infrastructure established, to get email programs modified so they automatically keep track of keys and encrypt and decrypt without you having to worry about it. On the other hand, some of it's happened very fast. That encrypt, as you may have noticed, any time you do anything on the web, you're every once in a while running into secure pages. And what does that mean? It means that those pages are rolling up a public key-private key pair, sending you the public key, you're sending stuff back, and therefore the whole transaction is encrypted. So that's a transparent, easy way of using encryption that's already happening. That's the future. It's going to be a mixed future. I don't want to predict beyond 30 years, because I've concluded there are too many technologies out there that could radically change the world in 30 years, but that's my current guess. Thank you.